I'm in Glendale, California today, taking a tour of the Museum of Neon Art. Neon lights were invented by the French engineer Georges Clot. He first demonstrated neon lighting at the Paris Motor Show in 1910, where he introduced the neon lamp to the public. But the true origins of what we consider a neon sign goes back a bit further. Developed in the 1850s by the scientist and glassblower Heinrich Geissler, the Geissler tube was one of the first lights that operated by illuminating pressurized gases in shaped glass tubes, producing similar effects to our modern neon signs by using rarefied gases such as argon. Like the neon signs we see today, they were powered by electrodes on either end of the glass chamber that would run a current through the gas inside, causing it to light up. Geissler's tubes were mainly produced and displayed as curious decorations and scientific novelties, but they could be found in a number of laboratories, including Nikola Tesla's. This was actually the beginning of Tesla's interest in wireless power. Tesla had a selection of Geissler tubes in his lab, and one day, when he was fiddling with one of his Tesla coils, the scientist noticed that the Geissler tubes began to light up in succession as he turned the coils to different frequencies. They were reacting to the electromagnetic energy being transmitted by the coils. Born in 1856, Tesla was responsible for many inventions that have changed the world, including the AC electrical system that we use today, the induction motor, remote control, radio, X-ray imaging, and early concepts of radar. He also explored the possibilities of communication with intelligences beyond what we know, including those allegedly inhabiting other dimensions, as well as ideas about signals from Mars or other planets. That said, Nikola Tesla was fascinated by the concept of prana, as he was influenced and inspired by ancient Vedic philosophy. It is apparent that he studied several ancient practices of Tibetan Buddhism and Hindu Tantra, which he likely encountered through his interaction with Swami Vivekananda, an Indian Hindu monk recognized for his knowledge of esoteric yoga. Tesla began using the Sanskrit term prana in his work to describe what he understood as energy or life force. In his article titled Man's Greatest Achievement, Tesla described the universe in terms of a primary substance or ether acted upon by prana, which he equated with creative or life-giving force known as qi in parts of Asia and vril among European alchemical societies. He wrote, quote, "All perceivable matter comes from a primary substance, or tenuity beyond conception, filling all space, the akasha or luminiferous ether, which is acted upon by the life-giving prana or creative force, calling into existence, in never-ending cycles, all things and phenomena." Tesla was particularly struck by the resemblance between the Vedic theory of matter and energy and modern physics, as discussed with Vivekananda in 1896. This meeting was influential, leading Tesla to explore how Vedic cosmology could intersect with his scientific work, focusing on the idea that force and matter could be reducible to potential energy, aligning with his views on energy and matter's fundamental nature. Tesla's engagement with these concepts was not just theoretical. He saw them as foundational to understanding the universe's mechanics, which he sought to harness through his inventions. His perspective was one where energy or prana and matter or akasha were part of an interconnected cyclical system of creation and dissolution, resonating with his broader views on energy, frequency, and vibration. According to historical accounts, Tesla filed for a patent for what some describe as the world's first flying saucer. This design includes features like a discoidal capacitor for thrust and smaller capacitors for directional control, alongside a gyroscopic stabilization system and an electric drive control. After Tesla's death in 1943, his papers, including those potentially related to such advanced technological concepts, were seized by the U.S. government, fueling speculation around the idea of anti-gravitic propulsion technology commonly associated with UFOs. Some believe that his ideas might have been explored or even implemented by the military in secret projects. While Tesla's actual involvement in developing a UFO-like flying disc remains speculative, there are those that claim the technology that creates a gravitic distortion in space can also allegedly manipulate time, or at least allow one to perceive probable futures or past events. The first public reference to a Project Looking Glass came from the legendary UFO whistleblower Bob Lazar, back when he first emerged into the public realm in 1989, when he identified it as one of the classified projects run out of the S4 facility at Area 51. In an interview, Bob Lazar replied to a question about the project as follows. Wasn't there something about Looking Glass, Project Looking Glass? Bob replied, yeah, that was later on, when we started getting into the heavy physics of it, because gravity distorts space and time, and what they were trying to do, distort time to see whatever event they were trying to observe through a gravitational lens. So that was a different project they were dealing with that, but that was essentially playing with gravity distorting time. Here is a more recent interview where Lazar explains how the gravity propulsion systems inside a UFO work to Joe Rogan, where he makes the point that gravity affects time and therefore the propulsion system can manipulate space-time itself.
There was talk of weapon systems, that there were different projects. Project Galileo, Project Sidekick was supposed to be weapon applications of the craft. Project Looking Glass had to do with time, any effects of time in the craft. Now, I don't think we're not talking about making a time machine like in science fiction, but we're talking about, you know, small distortions, intentional distortions of time, and how that can be used, you know, as a it was part of a weapon program.
How are you informed in this? About
these, again,
this?
Were there just the small briefings that I read. But again, I don't really like to talk about those because I don't have any information on them, and it was just, you know, small
right.
briefings.
But you told Commander Fravor that what he saw might have been a time dilation and not
it, well,
gravity
it could be
propulsion.
Because yeah. gravity affects time, you know, space yes. time. I'm sure you've heard of that.
What's fascinating to me, too, is that you were discussing this, the way this reactor worked, and that these things were not really connected.
No, nothing is connected. There's no wiring at all.
That freaks me the fuck out.
Charge your iPhone, you know.
Yeah.
Like,
well, wireless.
The little, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, electromagnetic.
Tesla.
Yeah, I know, again, but that's just simple electromagnetic induction.
Right, it's, but I mean, Tesla, the scientist, had this concept of
right,
that's what he's,
yeah, yeah.
That's what I'm talking about.
I mean,
about.
For other
yeah.
people that don't know what we're saying, he wanted to send wireless electricity through the sky, and Westinghouse was like, get the fuck out of here with that. Like when anybody could just pull electricity out of the sky.
Can't meter it.
Yeah, they couldn't. Yeah. They couldn't
we
meter
had this
it.
Talk on the
yeah.
car right over. I'm trying to chill him out. You know, we're talking about Tesla and how he couldn't be metered and how it all went down. So it's funny you bring it up.
Yeah.
According to claims made by military intelligence insiders, the Looking Glass technology facilitated the ability to look backward and forward in time, using the consciousness of the operator as a type of steering mechanism. The operator would sit in a chair capable of interfacing with consciousness directly, allowing an individual to receive information by non-physical means.
And we can get into the Looking Glass a little more. That's a device whereby the secret government can see the past or the future, not exactly, but approximately.
This essentially describes the ability to remote view, wherein the subject can become cognizant of objects or locations, presumably independent of time, using mind-clearing techniques and theta states of consciousness. This is suggestive of a time-space mechanism in the universe, wherein the human mind is uniquely equipped to navigate in time, able to access memories of the past, gain awareness of events in the present, conceive of future possibilities, and even imagine alternative events that did not actually happen. In other words, if a mind is properly trained or aided by some sort of external technology, it could be used to access non-experiential data in the same way one can recall a memory. The Looking Glass device seems to be capable of the same type of process, to access a data stream from any conceivable location in space or time, steered via the consciousness of an operator. Nikola Tesla was known for his photographic memory, powerful imagination, and ability to visualize in three dimensions. He once said, quote, "My brain is only a receiver. In the universe, there's a core from which we obtain knowledge, strength, and inspiration." Nikola Tesla died alone in his hotel room on January 7, 1943. All of his possessions and personal files were confiscated by the U.S. government after his death, allegedly to stop them from falling into enemy hands. But what happened to them? I already made a video about Tesla's involvement in the Philadelphia Experiment, a top-secret project that attempted to give the Allied powers invisibility for the war effort. The technology associated with these experiments were said to have been able to manipulate space-time and was rumored to work on the same principles that allowed for anti-gravitic flight. Prior to his death, Tesla spoke of a death ray he was working on, which several nations were interested in, and so the FBI was sent in to secure his final work. As most people are aware by now, the man that last handled his belongings was none other than John Trump, the uncle of President Donald Trump.
When Nikola Tesla died suddenly in 1943 in a hotel room in New York, there was a lot of intrigue, since he was so brilliant and worked on so many important things like motors and x-rays. A lot of people were worried that his unreleased work would fall into the wrong hands. So the FBI got involved, and they just released 65 pages worth of documents surrounding that intrigue in response to a FOIA request from Muckrock. Apparently, Tesla's good friend Blois Fitzgerald told the FBI that Tesla told him that he had actually finished a revolutionary type of torpedo, which he hadn't told anyone about yet. And Fitzgerald said that Tesla also told him he completed a working model of a death ray and had hidden it in a lockbox in New York. Adding to the intrigue, Tesla had a relative he didn't like very much named Sava Kosanovich. Kosanovich was from Yugoslavia and had connections to the Axis powers, according to a New York Times source in the documents. And apparently Kosanovich was at the hotel on the night of Tesla's death and searched the lockbox. He ended up taking a few pictures only, apparently, nothing major, but still, the intrigue swirled. So just to make sure they didn't miss out on Tesla's death ray, the FBI decided to have an expert thoroughly look over all the stuff Tesla had left behind. That expert was an MIT engineer who had worked for the government on stuff like radar research, so they trusted him. And that MIT engineer was none other than Donald Trump's uncle, John G. Trump. So Donald Trump's actual uncle was the person to inspect Tesla's supposed death ray machine. For real, you can't make that up. Now to me, that's pretty funny. I mean, maybe that's why Trump's so confident when it comes to bragging about our military and bossing other countries around. Maybe his brilliant scientist uncle saw some secret plans of Tesla's that the president nephew now knows about.
The official story is that Trump's uncle did not find anything important. But given the media's habit of distorting the truth, especially in regards to wartime technology, many people question the validity of the official story. That said, here's a short clip of the events in John Trump's own words.
From New York, I boarded a plane to Boston to find Dr. John Trump of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Dr. Trump was now retired from the company he founded, High Voltage Engineering, but he agreed to meet me at the company office the next morning.
In the spring of 1943, Dr. Carl T. Compton, who was then president of MIT, asked me to go to New York and examine the effects of Nikola Tesla. These were contained in an upper floor of a warehouse somewhere in New York City. And I spent a good deal of time examining, one by one, the papers, the books, and various other memorials that he had accumulated. But I was particularly looking for something which would be evidence of a secret weapon which I was reminded by the agents, the two agents who were present during the entire time, was a matter of concern to the United States. In the course of this, I did come across a number of letters directed at the upper echelon of the British Empire, that is, I think, to the King and Queen, or perhaps just to the King of England, and also to the Tsar of Russia, explaining that he was the inventor of a secret weapon which had rather remarkable properties, and that he would be interested in entering into a negotiation which would lead to a disclosure of what they were. Of course, I spent a good deal of time looking through these papers, trying to find out what the nature of this secret weapon was. I think I had, although I don't remember it so very accurately, an idea of what its properties were. It had the capability of acting at a great distance, of being destructive to flying objects and things of that kind at a place which was remote from the source. But nowhere in his technical papers did I find anything which revealed an explanation of just how such a device could operate.
I believe that you also opened another box, supposedly a secret weapon, that he left at another hotel. Can you relate that story, please?
Yes, when I had substantially concluded my study on the following day, I think that was a Saturday morning, I was reminded by one of the two agents that there was a box being held as a security for an unpaid obligation, and that this box was an item of considerable value and may indeed itself be the secret weapon, that it was armed and therefore it probably was not touched.
Were you nervous doing this?
I found it a matter of a bit of concern. However, I realized that this had to be done, and so we taxied down to this hotel. The agents identified themselves and their credentials to the assistant manager of the hotel, who led us to a room. This room was essentially empty, except for a table and a steel cabinet against the wall, which was opened. I think perhaps he opened it with a key. The cabinet itself was empty, except on one of the lower shelves was a package, a box, a rectangular box of ordinary size, which was wrapped in brown wrapping paper. It turned out to be a highly polished box with brass clasps, and it looked more like an instrument case. And after waiting a while and listening a while and remembering that it had been there for quite a few years, I think it had actually been there for about 5 years, as a security, I opened it. My report to Dr. Compton was that I saw no danger in releasing these papers and these relics to his heirs.
Miss Musar had arrived too late to know who had opened Dr. Tesla's safe or what had been removed. And Dr. Trump had found nothing which he considered dangerous or a secret weapon. Tesla had been a naturalized American citizen for 54 years, so why were his papers seized by agents of the custodian of alien property? I suspect that governments other than those of the United States, England, and Russia were interested in the inventions of Dr. Tesla.
Indeed, governments other than the United States, England, and Russia were interested, as this was 1943, at the height of World War II, and the most technologically advanced nation in the world at the time was Germany. While it's a fact that Germany did not win the war, it's also a fact that military expeditions continued immediately following the official end of the war, such as Operation High Jump, which was a literal invasion of what was an allegedly German military base in Antarctica that was rumored to house Germany's most advanced technology, as well as the last battalion of the SS, which never surrendered in 1945. While there are those that question the speculation regarding Operation High Jump, they are often the same people that question the Battle of Los Angeles in 1942, where disc-shaped craft hovered above the west coast of the United States for hours, or the alleged disc-shaped craft that crashed in Roswell, New Mexico in 1947, or the disc-shaped craft that, according to national press, outran jets and flew over the White House with impunity in 1952.
Well, actually, what this booklet does, it discusses a great many of these sightings around Washington, D.C., particularly those of mid-July 1952, when about a dozen of the things came over. About a dozen of them came over one night. They were tracked by radar. They were seen visually. They followed the planes in, and according to the CAA's own booklet, the pilots got good looks at the things as they followed them in and out of the airport. Some of them hovered. Some of them went around the Capitol building. Some went over the monument and the White House and over the deep freeze and circled all around there. They were seen plainly. There was no question about them being there. And as a matter of fact, the officials were so concerned about it that on the following morning, they issued a shoot-'em-down order. Why didn't they shoot 'em down the first night? They didn't shoot 'em down because the jets couldn't catch them, and they've never been able to catch one yet. The jets couldn't catch them. The next night they showed up. The jets didn't go up after them. They didn't go up with their shoot-'em-down order for the simple reason that Alfred Einstein and others of comparable standing heard about the shoot-'em-down order because the story was on the front pages all over the world. They heard about this shoot-'em-down order, and they personally got in touch with the little man in the White House, and I know what Mr. Einstein told him. He said, "Mr. President, anyone who can cross millions of miles of space will be able to take care of himself after he gets there. Don't start something you can't finish." That was one time that Give 'em Hell Harry decided it would be better not to give 'em any hell.
The official word from the U.S. government regarding flying saucers at the time was either that they were weather balloons or aliens from another planet. The idea being that they could control both sides of the story, whether people believed that they were real or fake, as long as they did not suspect that they originated on Earth, especially by German nationalists that they could not defeat, whose technology would make the Rockefeller energy sector monopoly obsolete. While these craft posed a national security threat, the threat of free energy was arguably of greater concern, as it directly challenged big oil and their stranglehold on the world economy. It was Nikola Tesla who said, quote, "Before many generations pass, our machinery will be driven by a power obtainable at any point in the universe. This idea is not novel. We find it in the delightful myth of Antheus, who derives power from the earth. We find it among subtle speculations of one of your splendid mathematicians. Throughout space, there is energy. Is this energy static or kinetic? If static, our hopes are in vain. If kinetic, and this we know it is, for certain, then it is a mere question of time when men will succeed in attaching their machinery to the very wheel work of nature." In a 1964 televised interview, George Van Tassel, who claimed to have had physical contact with Nordic, human-looking extraterrestrials, says that they showed him technology that could be used to view a visual scene from any historical time period by manipulating time, and which the U.S. Navy had in its possession. Van Tassel said that the technology was quickly classified and seemed to be very similar to what was described decades later by Bob Lazar as Project Looking Glass, which he also said was run by the Navy.
On the bottom side of the disc are the three gravity generators. When they want to travel to a distant point, the disc turns on its side. The three gravity generators produce a gravitational beam. What they do is they converge the three gravity generators onto a point and use that as a focal point. Then they essentially bring them up to power and pull that point towards the disc. The disc itself will attach onto that point and snap back as they release space back to that point. Now, all this happens in the distortion of time, so time is not incrementing, so the speed is essentially infinite.
So it's safe to talk about flying saucers and people from outer space, people who may be circulating among us now and who demonstrate their unearthly qualities if they choose you as one of their agents, and who land on this materialistic earth in flying saucers. No way. I'm not really joking. Because I've got a man now, here and now, one of the men who claims fervently that he has met these people from outer space, has talked to them, and has been given secrets of things such as a time machine from men from outer space. You'll meet this man after this plebeian and earthly message. The man you're going to meet in a moment or two, Tassel, from Giant Rock, California, is a most unlikely person to claim to have seen flying saucers and been in touch with people from outer space. George is a very ordinary fellow. He doesn't make any money out of his flying saucer beliefs, but boy, he really believes them. And before I start talking to George, I want to tell you, too, that I do have a couple of doubts in my mind. We all see these newspaper reports from Socorro, New Mexico, that a mysterious craft landed and took off and left blast marks in the sand. Airline pilots from time to time talk delicately about strange aircraft circling their normal aircraft in flight, perhaps even cutting off the power of their engines momentarily. We all love to talk about the mysterious and the unknown and the flying saucers. So now it's to George Van Tassel. And this question, time machine you're building down in California.
Well, Jack, this was the result of a formula which was given to me by a man who landed a ship at my airport in 1953. And we put this formula under research, tested a number of experiments on a bench in a good electronics lab in Chicago, and we produced phenomenal results with evidence that we should do it on a larger scale in order to be able to do more with it. And this evolved out of something that started in 1953 into a four-story high machine that we're working on down there today.
Now, George, I don't care whether the machine is four stories high or 40 stories high or 4 inches high. When I say calmly and unexcitedly, a time machine, what does your formula tell you you can do with a time machine?
Well, Jack, our formula has no time factor, which electronic formula does have. And on the other hand, electronic science has only had two dimensions to work with, the electric pattern and the magnetic pattern perpendicular to it. And we discovered a third zone, which we call a time zone, and we are working through this zone with an effort to orient the magnetic field to give us other results than our science can obtain at present.
George, just double talk to me. A time machine means to me a little box that I can go into and go back 5,000 years or forward 10,000 years. Is that what your formula tells you you can do?
Well, Jack, this isn't a little box. This is a four-story machine focusing fields that we can orient to produce this zone big enough for a man to get into. It isn't a box.
But what happens to the man when he gets into the zone?
I'm all
agog with curiosity.
Jack, we've discovered this zone is subject to thought. Now, since time doesn't record events the way we do on calendars and clocks, you could only record an event by thinking of it. Now, theoretically, we believe we can take a videotape magnetic camera into the time zone and photograph Lincoln's Gettysburg Address or Caesar's armies marching or anything that's ever happened.
All right, let me get this straight. In other words, you're telling me, like H.G. Wells imagined 50 years ago, that everything that happened in time is still there to be seen by the recreation electronically of a thought which exists.
Jack, you know how you talk into a tape on a tape recorder and play the interruptions back, identical to the play that you made. The Earth's magnetic field is the same way. You can put interruptions into it and play them back out of it. an associate of ours in creating a magnetic coupler with this principle, coupled in the Earth's magnetic field and played back TV shows from stations that aren't even in business anymore.
You mean that an experiment has been done to bring out of the air television programs which have been and gone?
Been and gone.
Now, where was this experiment conducted?
It was conducted in Santa Monica by an associate of mine.
Why hasn't this hit the headlines throughout the world? That's a time machine in action, if I can...
Well, Jack, the reason it hasn't hit the world is because, as I understand it now, the Navy Department took him and the research over because he also discovered he could bounce magnetic echoes off the ionosphere and locate submarines under the ocean, regardless of where they were.
So who is this associate of yours?
This is a fellow named Charlie Arts.
Charlie Arts?
Yeah.
And is he a free man walking around today?
Well, he's free where he is in this super-secret research he's conducting.
Now, so therefore, you tell me soberly in front of this television camera that things, old television programs, have been recreated out of nothing.
Played back with a picture and the sound just as good as the day they were broadcast. We've done this many times.
Why didn't you bring one up with you?
Well, this requires quite a piece of apparatus. This magnetic coupler works on around 50,000 volts, and it doesn't have any radio frequency connected with it. And actually, the television set which plays back the picture doesn't even have an antenna connected to it.
You have a time machine planned. You have done experiments which show you can bring the past to life. Where did this formula come from?
I love that Scotch accent. Jack, the formula came from a ship that landed at my airport in 1953 on August the 24th, which had four people aboard it that came from another planet.
I'm breathless.
Well, you're not only breathless, I was breathless.
But I'm cynical, too.
Well, that's fine. That's the way to be. In fact, I'm a bigger skeptic than you are of many things.
I'm an unbeliever. Convince me that this really happened to you.
That what is occurring now has occurred before. There's many records of these ships landing throughout history, clear back into Sanskrit. And there are records in the 1898 Chicago newspapers that covered the front page for 3 days of a big ship setting over Chicago.
But I want to go back to that night in 1953. Tell me, where did this happen for people who haven't heard you talk or seen you yet?
It happened on my airport, which I've operated for the last 16 years, at Giant Rock Airport, 17 miles north of Yucca Valley in California, or 40 miles north of Palm Springs.
Now, this is a private airport for small aircraft, is it?
This is an airport used both by the military and private aircraft.
You own this airport, do you?
I lease this airport from the United States government. I've operated it for 16 years since I retired from the flight test business and the aviation.
Right now. How old are you now, by the way, George?
I'm 54, Jack. Got three grown daughters, married, and 11 grandchildren.
You don't mind if I ask you the stock question? I know that you've been asked every obnoxious question that can ever have been asked. You've never been treated for any form of emotional upset.
I've never had any emotional upset other than women.
Except that night in Yucca Flats, not Yucca Flats, a Giant Rock, when this ship appeared. Now, give me the details, George, because I'm never tired of hearing the details of a man who says he has seen creatures from another world.
Well, actually, Jack, this was as simple as crossing a street and getting hit by a car. After it's over, you're the victim of the circumstance. And I didn't see the ship land. One of my son-in-laws, that wasn't my son-in-law at that time, saw it come down. Another man on the airport heard it, and he wasn't where he could see it. And the man got off of the ship and approached me before I even knew there was a ship down.
What did you see?
A bell-shaped type of anti-gravity ship that they operate as a scout ship out of their big carriers.
How big?
This was 36 feet in diameter and 19 feet high.
And where was it, on the ground?
No, it was hovering 10 feet off the ground. And there were three men on the ship, besides the one that had got off and invited me aboard.
You keep calling them men. What do you mean, men?
Well,
little green men?
They could have walked in our clothes down any of our streets and we wouldn't have paid any attention to them.
And did these people tell you where they came from?
They didn't say where they came from, but I've been in the air game since 1927, and their instruments were unlike anything I'd ever seen before.
Well, don't give me technicalities. What was different?
The difference was that we used dial instruments, and they used vertical instruments, like fluorescent tubes with marks on them.
What color were these people?
The instruments were marked in symbols similar to hieroglyphics. They were not in any language or number system we use on the Earth.
What color were these people?
They looked like they were white people with a good, healthy tan.
And was that your only contact with the...
That was the only contact I had with the people from the ship.
Did you have any... Have you had any other contacts with people?
I've had a recent contact last September, 1963.
Well, I don't have to ask you. Tell me.
Well, in this case, they drove a car into the airport. They didn't come in a ship. They're walking among us on the Earth all the time, and we don't realize it.
As wild and fantastic as that sounds, it was largely supported by Naval Intelligence Officer William Tompkins, who worked with U.S. spies during World War II, that claimed the German Reich had anti-gravitic craft and the ability to distort space-time. He also claimed that military intelligence was now in possession of this technology and that governments work with Nordic people from elsewhere. In fact, he himself alleges to have personally worked with what he describes as these Nordics.
At the end of the war, Germany had already removed massive, not underground, in mountain. All over Germany and the occupied countries, Germany was building mass production of a dozen different types of extraterrestrial vehicles using slave labor with hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of in-mountain massive facilities. 80% of that had all been removed from Germany 6 months before the war ended. It had all been taken to Antarctica, and they were continuing the construction down there. They had access to these with their submarines. They built massive truck submarines, enormous submarines, to bring all this stuff down to Antarctica. So the submarine, still submerged, goes through these tunnels. They go back through the tunnels, and they get to a lake where there's all these facilities in the cities and naval bases and towns and thousands of people. Now, what this turned out to be, after I got heavily into this, was this is the first time anybody in the United States knew that extraterrestrials were actually here on the planet and actually were working with Germany, had agreed, legal agreements with Hitler. We then had these Navy spies, which we had operating there 24 hours a day from 1942 to the end of the war. I worked in that office.
There was a young lady in Europe who was named Maria Orsic. Now, she was sort of tapped on the shoulder and told a very strange thing. They told her she should get her friends together, all the people you knew, and people that were in different technical fields, many, many people, and design a kilometer-long space transport. So in my book, Selected by Extraterrestrials, I talk about Maria, and I have 14 different places in my book about the people that helped her. And it got to be 1,443 people were working with her to design and build a kilometer-long commercial-type space transport, okay? There were shoe salesmen. There were farmers. There were technicians. There were engineers. There were scientists. All these people were working together to design a massive space transport. Of course, the SS found out. And now we have these people from a different part of the galaxy. They're called Nordics. Whoops, I didn't want that in there. Wait a minute, you don't realize I'm working hard. This is hard work in the Navy. And yes, I do have my own photo lab for all these secret documents that we have to come up with. And the girl second from the left, she's in our office, and I've been dating her for quite a while. I got a good job, good pay, all right? And so I'm in there for only 4 weeks. They take me out of the wind tunnel group, and they put me into a secret lab. They found out about my background. So now what we're doing in Northrop, now you know who Northrop is. They're the guys that do the flying wings, right? They build the flying wings. But that's not what we're doing. We're building airplanes that fly in space, all different kinds of space planes that can fly in atmosphere. So the one you're looking at here is just one of hundreds. This went on for 2.5 years. I worked a short time after Northrop at North American and over at Lockheed. Actually, I worked for Lockheed actually three times. What I want to explain is that the vehicles that we designed for all of these missions after the moon mission are massive. They're like 40 times the size of the little Apollo over here on the side of the picture, okay? Just as we got ourselves started on this, three people came in and landed over at Las Vegas. They spent 2 weeks in Vegas. Then they came over to Douglas. And it turned out that one of the girls was then the section chief for the propulsion group. And the other girl was my second. She was my section chief's typist, okay? So here we have two beautiful Nordic girls and this good-looking Nordic guy that helps them. He's not there all the time. Who are contracted to make sure that we do all of the Apollo. Wow. Hey, this is cool. Now, you have to look at my secretary. Yes, she does look like somebody else, okay? But she has a sense of humor that you absolutely cannot, you can't ignore. Now, she's brilliant. Now, when I'm in a meeting on the Apollo, in the conference room with 15 or 16 other of the top people, and we're fighting this problem for, say, 3, maybe 4 hours, and we can't lick this one. She puts it in my head, and she says, Billy, why don't you just say, use so-and-so? And that was the answer that we needed on the Apollo program to handle this. She puts that stuff in my head. And now it's my idea. I get credit for it, okay? I'm going up like this. And she does this every single day. She comes up with something again that's absolutely needed, and it's never wrong. It's always the right answer. And I had this girl for 4 years on the Apollo program, okay? She's brilliant. You can't believe what she knows, but she's a Nordic. She's here from the Nordic Navy. She's a full commander in the Nordic Navy. Oh, my God. And she's not 17. She's a whole lot older than that. Okay? But she still looks 17. You can't believe what that 4 years was. So, not being able to meet any of the contracts from NASA on RS-4B, because we are orders of magnitude more advanced than anything that the paperclip guys could even know how to do. So I put this into a package. I have the model. I fly it down to the NASA base, and my secretary told me over the phone, actually she told me, talking to me before I left, and she said, I wrote you a letter to get you into NASA, but you're not going to need it. The elevator opens, we go upstairs, we go to the top floor, that elevator opens, and Von Braun is in this side, and Dr. Debus is in the other side. That's a great big office, and there's an enormous conference room table between it. And we ended up, they guaranteed us a $79 million systems engineering contract.
Dr. Hermann Oberth, who pioneered rocket design for the German Reich during World War II, and later advanced rocket technology for the American manned space launches, cryptically stated, quote, we cannot take the credit for our record advancement in certain scientific fields alone. We have been helped. When asked by whom, he replied, the people of other worlds. He then went on to say, it is my thesis that flying saucers are real and that they are spaceships from another solar system. There is no doubt in my mind that these objects are interplanetary craft of some sort. I and my colleagues are confident that they do not originate in our solar system. Dr. Walter Riedel, who was once chief designer and research director at the German Rocket Center at Peenemünde, said, quote, I'm completely convinced that UFOs have an out-of-world basis. Jack Parsons was the founder of both the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, or JPL, and the Aerojet Engineering Corporation, not to mention inventor of solid-state rocket fuel. Wernher von Braun called him the father of American rocketry. That said, Parsons was also a high-ranking sex magician in Aleister Crowley's occult religion, as well as roommates with L. Ron Hubbard, the founder of the Church of Scientology, who happened to also be a naval intelligence officer during World War II. In disclosed documents leaked after a court case of Scientology's highest secret esoteric level, known as OT-8 Confidential Student Briefing, Hubbard disclosed his belief that the Earth is effectively a prison planet that is controlled by a relatively small sect that has the occult ability or technology to perceive outside of linear time and therefore covertly manipulate and steer events on Earth. Which brings us to the underground vaults of the Vatican, where among its hidden subterranean archives is said to be the Chronovisor, a device believed to have been built in the early 50s or 60s by an Italian scientist and priest, Father Pellegrino Maria Ernetti, that apparently allows people to view the future and witness historical events as they unfolded. Ernetti asserted that the Chronovisor operated by detecting and decoding residual electromagnetic radiation left behind by past events, citing a team of scientists and Nobel laureates who collaborated on the project. Yet the Vatican, where Ernetti claimed the Chronovisor was developed, has remained tight-lipped about its existence. Church officials neither confirmed nor denied Ernetti's assertions, adding additional layers of mystery to the story. But some argue that the church might be safeguarding such a device due to the potential implications on historical and religious narratives. Whether the Chronovisor is a genuine invention or a clever fabrication, its alleged ability to display past events by tapping into the vibrational frequency left behind, implying that every moment creates an imprint of energy on a timeline, kind of like how we record and can play back music, is interesting in light of Tesla's work and modern findings in quantum physics and electromagnetic fields, allowing it to connect with the theoretical quantum or plasma field that holds all possible timelines and events. If such a scenario exists, then Project Looking Glass raises some big questions about free will versus determinism. Some theorists suggest that those in power have discovered a future timeline that elites running the world don't want to see happen. Maybe it's the expected dawning of an age of a global awakening of humanity, and they're now using this looking glass to manipulate timelines in an effort to delay and prolong the inevitable. Maybe more than one organization or faction has access to similar technology, competing to influence desired timelines. Maybe the outcome of past historic events, such as civil wars or World War II, were already covertly altered. If we accept the testimonies and information gathered from Lazar, Van Tassel, Tompkins, Oberth, and many others, then it is clear that the U.S. military intelligence community has likely acquired what may have originally started out as off-world anti-gravitic technology, also developed by the Germans, and has been conducting Project Looking Glass since at least the early 50s, with some independent researchers claiming that both the military intelligence community and other unelected elements in the deep state are using time-distorting technologies to peer into the future, used by different factions to potentially anticipate each other's future moves. That said, it has been reported that President Donald Trump is not only aware of the Nordic presence and their technological influence, but is on the verge of disclosing it to the public. Maybe that is why he's been so optimistic lately and always dancing. My name is Robert Sepper. I'm an anthropologist. My published work is available on Amazon and through all other major book outlets. If you'd like to support my work, you can do that through Patreon or various links available in the description section. Please subscribe and leave me your thoughts below as I read all the comments. Stay safe, and I hope to see you again soon.